You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. So I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with myself, Ian O'Connell, is Noel Brown. Noel Brown is a retired anti-gang investigator who spent 41 years fighting organised crime and worked on some of Ireland's biggest and well-known cases, and Noel faced some of Ireland's most notorious criminals throughout his career working as a Garda inspector. Sit back and enjoy the show. Noel, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. I'm delighted to have you on for a chat about your own career. It's been a very interesting career, I suppose to say the least. So thanks a million for joining me today. How are you?
Good, Ian, and thanks for having me. And hopefully I can have a chat and your listenership will maybe learn a little bit about life in An Garda Síochána and the guards over the last 4 decades, really, you know. So glad to be here and hopefully people find it interesting.
Absolutely. I suppose, was it always something that you are interested in, all? I suppose, because nowadays, I suppose, true crime is such a big thing now, and there's so many documentaries and people are interested. Were you like that growing up when you were younger?
No, actually, probably the opposite in a way. I grew up in Mayo and born into a small farm in the west of Ireland. I'm sure that a lot of your listenership in Kerry will empathise with that. And born into a small farm, South Mayo, Galway border area, Kilmaine is the name of the place. And a law-abiding family and all of that, but nobody in the guards, or no aunts or relatives or uncles or anybody like that in guards at all. And it's down to really to a local sergeant who called me aside in the early 1980s and suggested to me that maybe a life in the guards would be something that I should try. He pushed me towards it, to be honest. And at the same time, I attended a career guidance officer in Tuam in County Galway, which is a local town. And basically, I got the same advice. So, hey presto, I ended up in Templemore in 1983, came in the top 100 of about 10,000 applicants for the guards at the time. And before I knew it, I was supposed to walk on the beat in Dublin the following December 83.
And you mentioned Templemore there, I suppose. Back then, what was the application like? Was that a lot different to now?
I would think so, yeah, because over the years I've been in and out of the, we call it the Una Trainola back then, or the training centre, and then got college status and became much more like a third level institution, I suppose. But back in the 80s, it was very much like, I suppose, a militaristic boot camp type place. You know, you didn't get home weekends. You were basically confined to barracks most of the time, curfew at 9 or 10 p.m., this sort of stuff.
Do you think in one way, when it was like that back then, all that, it probably stood you in the long term?
Yeah, I mean, there's pluses and minuses to everything that we do, isn't there? So you know, I do think that a lot of it was definitely to build up a camaraderie and build up a good relationship with colleagues, and also, you know, discipline, big part of it, to be honest. And that beneficial, but I suppose the other side of that coin is that you also don't want to create too much of a them and us situation. Like, the guards have a great tradition of being community oriented and community based, and I think we managed to keep that down through the decades and hopefully continue to do so. But certainly then maybe nowadays there's a lot more emphasis on human rights training and all those sort of areas, that whilst we, you know, we were doing the same work and had the same ideals, it wasn't put into words or into lectures quite clearly as it is nowadays. And with the emphasis on codes of ethics and all of that, which should drive towards trying to ensure that people abide by those codes of ethics and by high standards.
I heard you in a podcast saying your first outing was in Christchurch. Was it at the ringing of the bells? That would have been your first time out, one of the first, would it?
Yeah, that's right, because back then we passed out in December 83, which was a sad time for An Garda Síochána, because recruit guard, the Gary Sheehan, had been and Private Kelly had been shot dead in Ballinamore just the weeks before, and so traumatic time in many times, many ways for the guards. But then we passed out, and we actually passed out the day after St. Stephen's Day. You had to be back down in Templemore and then deployed up to Dublin, as so many were. And then next thing you knew it, you were standing on Christchurch, basically dealing with public order situations. At that time, the ringing of the bells in Christchurch was quite an exciting night, I'll put it that way. And there would be a lot of activity there, some of it not good, but well, no, I quickly learned that Dublin people, with their wit and the characters that you meet along the way, I mean, it's from the get-go, you get to appreciate that in Dublin, as everywhere else, 95% of the people are absolutely fine, and you do learn that I suppose fast, that you have to be able to give and take a little bit of slagging and all the rest of it, and that's a good night to start, because you know people have a few beers in them, and I suppose we'll say the crack was good, you know.
Did you change location for a while over to North Dublin?
Yeah, I started out, you see, in Donnybrook was my first posting, and at that time, Donnybrook had a lot of, and still has a lot, it's kind of the embassy belt, so there's a lot of protection posts, we call them static duty posts, where you, with places like, obviously the big ones would have been the British Embassy, the US Embassy, and a number of others as well. So a lot of your working day was taken up with doing fairly boring, I suppose, to be honest, protection duty. So guys and girls that get stationed in Donnybrook, some stayed on and went on to do great things. Others, a lot of us then would look to go to kind of more districts where in the city where obviously you weren't tied down with those sort of things. So I looked to get over to the north side, and because there was vacancies over there at the time. So I ended up in Santry in the H district, we'd call it. I still call that Santry, Ballymun and Whitehall were the district, and so yeah, I went over there, and I wanted to experience a place where you go to work every hour of your working day was dealing with the public or dealing with policing duties, and that you weren't tied down doing static protection posts and that type of stuff. So it went on from there. I then moved to Clondalkin in West Dublin, and onwards from there to Crumlin, where I was assigned to a street crime task force type patrolling, which is, you know, very interesting work, and I found it interesting, and that's how my career progressed onwards from, and it went on from there, as we'll sure we'll talk about.
And I suppose the big thing I suppose after that was obviously the murder of Veronica Guerin. That was a very, I suppose, significant time in Irish history and in the when you were, I suppose, getting into it. Where were you? Can you remember back to that day? It's something like something that happens in the world that you always know where you are and what you were doing at that time.
Like that 26th of June 96 was, I suppose, a sad moment, and a key moment in the history of organized crime in Ireland, when Veronica Guerin, rest in peace, was murdered at the on the Naas Road. I was actually off duty that day, and I think I'd been in court or something, as you would be, in the morning with something, and then at lunchtime I got a phone call to say that there was a lady had been attacked and murdered on the Naas Road, and that doesn't happen that often, a young mother or anything like that, thankfully. And but we did, I suspected straight away that it could well be Miss Guerin, because she had been the subject of earlier attacks and that, you know. But from that moment on, we were told, like, basically get into Clondalkin, and was assigned onto that investigation, and spent a number of years on it. All these investigations start out with a very large grouping involved, but then they gradually narrow into a tighter little group as the certain aspects and avenues of investigation are wound down. But you know, I actually should give a shout out here to a great carryman and mentor of mine, seeing as I'm on with yourselves, in Tony Hickey, who was the lead investigator of that investigation into the murder of Miss Guerin and other associated crimes. And you know, as you go along, I think the key thing in learning your trade or learning anything is to pick the right people to guide you and to take advice from. So I was very fortunate to work with now retired AC Tony Hickey, and Tony was, as I said, led out on that. But you know, it went on for years of investigation like that, and it took us to many places that I thought I'd never see, like including over to the Netherlands, and that started out my career, that aspect of my career, which had an international flavor to it. So that started really as far back as then, in at Murder 96, and then the investigations, we were still involved in murder trials and everything going up to 2000 into 2001.
Because you did fly out to Amsterdam or the Netherlands as part of that investigation, didn't you?
Yeah, the like I mean the as we saw then, and so we've seen more and more and more down the years that international or organized crime is very much an international business, and especially in the drug trafficking areas and other that vast majority of stuff is obviously imported from abroad, illegal drugs and weapons and all of that, and obviously the gang involved there, the Gilligan gang, as it became known as, they had huge connections in the Netherlands. So back and over to the Netherlands quite a lot, and there was a team of Dutch police assigned to work with us. Operation Red Setter, actually, is what they called it, in tribute to Irish breed of a dog. So we were there to and that's what sort of work that I became more and more involved in then through Europol and in the subsequent years, you know. So yeah, but from then on, big part of it, all those investigations, and you can see it to this day, is the international aspect.
John Gilligan was acquitted, but what interactions did you have with him, I suppose, in the recent time after the murder?
Well, John Gilligan left the jurisdiction not too long after the murder. But one of those direct interactions I had with him is that I was the sergeant in charge of the arrest party that was flown over to RAF Northolt in the UK. He had been arrested, you know, picked up in London, and then he fought his extradition back to Ireland through the courts. He was detained in Belmarsh High Security Prison, but eventually, they exhausted all the legal avenues in the UK, and it was held that he be extradited. So then we flew over and collected him at RAF Northolt, and I suppose those pictures have become quite famous of him in his, as they call it, the Teletubby suit, which is the high security suit that prisoners were obliged to wear over there. And we brought him back to Baldonnel, and then he was brought straight to the Special Criminal Court, and then criminal trials, you know, though he faced numerous charges, including drug trafficking, firearms trafficking, and the murder itself. And he was acquitted on the murder charges, but convicted on the drug trafficking charges.
And as the investigator, when someone is acquitted of it, Noel, is there a level of, I suppose, not disappointment because you just do as much as you can do, but then when it goes to the courts, when someone is like acquitted, is there a level of disappointment there?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I think the trick with working in the investigative business and all the rest of it is not to take it, to continue to say to young people, don't take it to heart, you know. I mean, don't personalize the whole business, because I think that's that gets you nowhere. You have to accept that you're not going to get everything across the line in terms of getting convictions. You can only do your level best, and present your cases to the firstly to the press, to the DPP, Director of Public Prosecutions, who may or may not even decide to prosecute in the first place. And we've often had discussions around that with the law officers, and you know, it's quite a feat to even get cases into the courts and get and mount a prosecution. Prosecutions cost millions of euro of the taxpayers' money. So it's not decisions that are taken lightly by the DPP to bring a prosecution, because if you don't have a fighting chance of a conviction in the first place, well, then you're going to waste a lot. It's the easiest thing in the world is to say, okay, let it down to court, as we would say, and run a trial. But that's cost a huge amount of money, taxpayers' money, as I said. So the DPP and nor do senior guard investigators want to be wasting money bringing prosecutions that you can't have a fight, or you don't see a fighting chance of getting it across the line. Then, having got the, when you do get the prima facie case into the courts, then the challenge is to actually get the conviction, and you're not going to get there all the time. You know, that's a reality, and things invariably happen in trials. Stuff can come out of the blue, or whatever. Witnesses can fail to appear, or can change their minds, shall I put it that way? And that happened in in John Gilligan's case, certain witnesses didn't prove to be as beneficial as we thought. But at the same time, he went to prison for a very long time for his activities in terms of the gang's activities. The other thing that has changed, I suppose, as well in the intervening period is that we now have a lot of gangland re legislation that didn't exist, back in the 90s, in the 2000s. We then had the advent of the organized crime legislation, which basically you see people being prosecuted under now in various trials in the courts. So you do what you can do, and then don't let it get in on you if you don't get it across the line. That's my advice.
I always wondered, when you are investigating something like that, and the, I suppose, journalists and the papers and stuff, they, I suppose, open it to the public, what's going on. As you're the one in the middle of the investigation, can that be a help or can it be a hindrance to, I suppose, to the whole thing?
Well, I think it's from an investigator's point of view, one has to be awful careful about what, and as an organization, what is released to the media and how information gets out in the media. Because the one thing you don't want to do is compromise a trial if there's one ongoing, where something gets into the public domain that can hinder or could collapse a prosecution. And it has happened from time to time for one reason or another. So yeah, the media is always a factor that's there, and we need the media. That it's a part of any democracy that the media will be there checking out and conducting, I suppose, in many ways, their own inquiries into what's going on in society in general, and not just in the police or in the Garda or whatever. But it's a fact that there's many things that we would be precluded from disclosing to the media. So, and in the interests of fairness overall. So, and even after trials are finished and all the rest of it, we might be party to information that, and we know the real reason why somebody didn't maybe present in court or whatever, or appear in court or change their evidence. But you have to be fair to them as well. There's issues around the protection of individuals and all of that. So my view on the media always was to leave that to somebody else, like Tony Hickey or somebody else like that. I'd leave that to those other guys and deal with them, because I didn't want to. You don't want to get caught in a situation where you say something, and again, with the best will in the world, people are trying to do their job as best they can, and as journalists are. But I found it was always easier to leave that to the press office or to people. Nowadays we would appoint somebody to deal with the media in terms of a big investigation. So leave
You have
that
to be,
to whoever's assigned to it.
you have to, I suppose, be careful as well, because you could say something in the media, they might try and twist your words and stuff. Do you know, you have to be very careful, do you?
Oh, well, you guys know, like, I mean, I'm going to treat you as a jerk. You'd never do a thing like that. But
An
no,
actor, no.
I'll just say that maybe things can be misinterpreted. Maybe and again, unfortunately, we see that nowadays. A snippet of a conversation can be taken out of context, or even a sentence or something like that. So I found it very much easier just to say nothing at all, So then you couldn't. That was my approach towards the media, but due respect to them.
When you are around the criminals, you have to be I suppose, like they're human, but obviously they've done bad stuff. Is there a level of not banter, but a bit of kind of camaraderie that you have to be careful not to let fall into their trap of being too nice? But can there be a bit of a, not a laugh, but you know what I mean, between you and the person?
Yeah, I mean, there's as many as there are criminals, there are personalities attaching to them, and some of them. Well, but I found that as time went on, most of them, as they that you would encounter, seasoned and I would say career criminals, they always know that there's always going to be police and detectives somewhere in the vicinity around them or investigating to some degree or another, Again, I go back to that whole thing of not personalizing, like making a personal vendetta, you v them and them v you. It can happen, and I've seen it happen where members of the guards being threatened and that tended to be more the younger 20-somethings, probably full of testosterone or whatever, but they haven't life hasn't hit them a few slaps just yet, and maybe a few prison sentences or whatever. But as time goes on, like the John Gilligans this world, dealing with him one to one, you would have absolutely not have a problem that I didn't, certainly didn't anyway. And there would be a bit of banter. I think he tried to thrive on the being witty as well. I mean, he'd joke with you and all the rest of it. But that's just life. I mean, again, don't personalize it. You can certainly you take a lot of abuse out on the street. I think young guards get far more abuse, dealing with people and one to ones, or dealing with people. Maybe they have a few some substances taken and are mouthy and all the rest of it on the street. But as you progress in the job, I think it actually gets that you get less of that. Maybe because people that you're dealing with are experienced criminals. They know that that's there's absolutely pointless in that. At the end of the day, they may have been like that when they were in their teens or 20s, as I said. But as if they survive the jungle that is gangland and are still at it in their 40s and 50s or even older, they tend to be much more, shall we say, calmer about life in general, and would often slag you or trade stories in a third party sense, or ask you about detectives that they hadn't seen in years. It's amazing, yeah, because they do get to know you and you get to know them, and you'll meet them. So maybe not socially, I don't mean you could be walking down Henry Street or walking down middle of Cork City or Killarney, God knows, or wherever, and you will bump into people, and I mean the thing is you have a nod an acquaintance with them, or there's no point. Again, I keep going back to that, just don't turn it into a vendetta sort situation. A very experienced chief super said to me one time, criminals will always be with us. There'll always be a criminal element in every society, and that's just a fact of life, and so don't take it to heart.
No, 100%, and like you said, you kind of get to know them. But if you met somebody and you met them again and a couple of times, they might build up a certain level of respect for you, would they?
Yeah, I suppose there would be that. You know what I mean? There's I often say to guards as well, if you can do someone a favor on some human level, it could be very simple things. I don't think you should ever turn down that opportunity, because it may come back to you. You could be rewarded for it in some way or another. And I mean simple little things like somebody is arrested or they're in under, we'll say, Section 30, and the girlfriend arrives in with his favorite runners or something. These are little practical things, and strictly speaking, you can put them into, sometimes we take the clothes off them and they're given alternative clothes just to, because the clothes need to be forensically examined, but they feel comfortable wearing their €200 Nike runner or whatever it is. So, yeah, look at giving them the runners. I mean, let's not get too het up about it. Simple little things, or maybe call around at the house when somebody's arrested and is an adult, but at the same time just say, listen, there might be people with serious drug problems or whatever, and let the family know, even though you're not obliged to do it because they're adults, but let somebody know in their circle that, look at X is in custody, he's going to be in for the night or whatever, and simple little things like that. Like you would get people saying to you, like, "Jeez, thanks for that." You didn't have to do it, but or whatever, or I'm trying to think of little examples, and they're only small things, but sometimes small things can send a big message, and you never know when that will come back to your benefit, down the road,
When did you actually join the National Drugs Unit, Noel?
Well, that would have been 2000. Yeah, when I was finishing up, basically on the Here an investigation was based out of Lucan Garda Station in West Dublin, and then, as I said, it went on about 4 or 5 years between all the inquiries and numerous inquiries, and all these cases, as you see, take a long, long time to bring to court, and to especially when there's, as I said, an international aspect to them. So then by 2000, 2001, I was appointed, I think 2001, appointed in as a detective sergeant into what was then known as the Garda National Drug Unit based in Dublin Castle.
Moving on, September, I suppose it was the start of a kind of a whole chain of events before the Regency. What was that like, I suppose, when Gary Hutch was shot, or in 20, was it around 2016?
2014, 2015, how the years are going by so quick. In 2015, yeah, Gary Hutch was murdered out in Spain, and as we now know, that triggered a series of events. There was a basically a criminal groupings in Dublin, which based around the Kinahan organization, as we now describe it. There was a lot of people involved in they had basically kind of taken on the role as being the kingpins of the drug trafficking networks in Dublin in particular, and probably outwards, and not probably, but outwards into a lot of regions of the country. And then they that grouping basically splintered, in that some of the Hutches were being alleged to be either informants, or had ripped them off on drugs or whatever, on a shipment or whatever. And so an internal dispute really is what developed, which turned into then what became known, kind of known as the Hutch Kinahan feud, as has been well documented. But back then, we were at that stage, the Drugs and Organized Crime Bureau was established in 2015, around the same time. The then Commissioner Noreen O'Sullivan, a lot of connections down your part of the world. Well, Glengariff actually, down south, Cork, but just over the border.
Not
But
too far away.
yeah, there was designation of different specialist national units in within the Guards at the time. So what everyone has to remember, looking back on that period, is that we had come out of the or gone through the financial crash in 2008 and onwards for a few years, and Garda resources, no more than resources in other areas of society, or the public services in particular, were really, really at a low ebb. And the capacity of the guards to gather information, to gather intelligence, to target these people was basically was weakened because of the lack of a recruitment. We had a moratorium on recruitment from about 2010 up till, I don't know, the 2013, 14. That is a knock-on effect, because if people aren't being fed into the system, new people coming in, coming out of Templemore, going on to the units around the country, and then people that have gained experience, they're the ones in the progress onwards into where I the places type of places I ended up in. So it's a kind of a progression there. But if there's no recruitment, no new blood, as it were, coming in, well, then there's stagnation, and other units and bureaus, as they're called, are then depleted in resources and numbers. And you need numbers and resources to go after these gangs and these organizations, to investigate whether it's newly developing cyber crimes type stuff or whatever. All of that pulls on the resources of the organization, and it pulls people away from what you see every day in your town and village in Kerry or wherever. And people do want to progress as well. Some people don't. Some people are very happy to do the work they do, and it's very important work in the towns and cities and villages and wherever around the place. But you need to. It's from that pool of people that you bring people into specialist units, whether it's in detective branches and so on. But if there's no recruitment, and there wasn't, and there was a moratorium on recruitment, so therefore everything has stagnated. So by 2014-15, I think our intelligence gathering capacities was much lower than one would wish. And into that vacuum, then inevitably will step criminal organizations to take advantage of that. And again, if they get away with a few crimes, like there was several murders that had happened pre-Gary Hutch, other people, lots of murders, supposed to be fair, and a lot of them are detected. But if criminals feel they can get away with something, they will do it. That's for sure. So if I can jump forward to the response that has happened in the years after the Regency attack, and onwards into the 2020s, like I think last year there was no gangland murder in the country. So that's not that doesn't happen by accident. It's because criminals, they're not stupid, in the sense that if they think that there's a more than even chance that they're going to be convicted and go to prison for a long time, well, then they're probably not going to do it. So, and also, if the heat is on them, as the old saying goes, they will step back from that type of activity. And I think we've seen that, and that's as a result of A, powerful legislation being brought into play, which I mentioned, the organized crime legislation, surveillance legislation, and then having the right people within the Garda organization and also within associated organizations at the other national bodies as well, like the customs, etc., working and using those legal tools, then you see the results. But to answer your question, I know I've gone a long way about it. In 2014-15, the guards were no more than the teaching professions or the nursing professions and the medical, you know, we were struggling as a nation to fulfill the roles and to fulfill the requirements that society would like us to be fulfilling. But if you don't have the resources and the personnel and the trained personnel, well, then unfortunately it's not, you're going to leave gaps in the system.
Two pieces on this question. A, what was your recollection of that day of the Regency, and B, was it in one way maybe not a wake-up call but for more resources and to change the kind of policing in Ireland after the Regency?
Yeah, well, I suppose the thing I remember about it was a Friday afternoon, and we were all going about our business doing whatever else we were doing on the given day, and then word starts coming through that there's been some sort of an attack out at the Regency Hotel in on the near the Whitehall, as we would call it, and I suppose, you know, people have asked me, was I shocked? I don't know if shock is the right word after, you know, I mean, you've seen so many things down the years, but certainly surprised at the audacity of it, you know, and you know, things move fast. Then, like, you know, I mean, I remember we. Later on that day or that evening or the next day, we called out to when these things, something like that, or any more, there incident rooms are set up and investigation teams are assembled, basically. And you hear that mentioned all the time, and that happens everywhere. And
is that always in the police station in the location where the crime happens?
It would be within the division, yeah, for sure. Yeah. You know, you're looking at simple or things like capacity issues. Conference rooms, you know, equipment, all of that sort of stuff. So, you know, it would definitely be set up, like, you know, probably in the district headquarters stations in the country divisional headquarters, where you got a good facilities where you can base a team, where they've got the very basics of a conference room and all the computerization and everything else you need. They're not going to set it up in a one man station out in, I don't know, Lixnaw, is that a station
yeah,
in Kerry,
yeah.
Is it, or somewhere?
Yeah.
or Kilmaine, in my case, in Mayo, or it would be set up somewhere in the division for sure. And then national units and all sorts of expertise are drawn in then to work with the local Gardaí to progress the investigation, you know? So that's how that works, you know? So, but the thing with the Regency was, I suppose we could see that there was probably going to be a lashback. So the whole other aspect of that business for them, there was hectic times. It was that that investigation has to be done. We call that an after the fact police work, where the crime has happened and now it's got to be investigated, you know. And but also you have what we would often talk about is before the fact investigations, which is basically where units and bureaus like the Drugs and Organized Crime Bureau works on intelligence-led operations, targeting the groups that we believe are likely to commit such crimes in the future. So you're working on one section of the guards is working to investigate what has happened, and there's other sections of the guards working to disrupt or dismantle the groups that are likely to perpetrate such crimes in the future, be it revenge for an attack that's already happened or for whatever reason. So they're intelligence led, and that's the type of work that I was mostly involved in. So there's various aspects to this. So that all of that was coming into play then in 2016, from that period onwards. And we saw then, you know, the work that went on then in terms of arrests and prosecutions of numerous people, part of the in an organization, maybe 60, 70 people, numerous firearms and weapons recovered. All of that doesn't happen by accident. A huge amount of work goes into that. And again, international cooperation comes into play. Criminals being brought in, Imre Arrakis, flown in from abroad to carry out a murder, that type of stuff. So you're working with international colleagues, you're working with regional colleagues around the country. So, and all of that has to be correlated and brought into a systematic investigation process, you know, and a huge amount of work on that. So that's the type of stuff that I was involved in then, or had been and continue to be involved in then up till 2021.
I want to chat about 2021 and your time in South America, but before we move on to that very quickly, do you think that the people that were involved in the Regency, would they see, in their eyes, would they see it as a failure because Daniel Kinahan got away?
It probably did, yeah. I mean, it's indicated that they came very close to getting Daniel, if we can put it that way, Kinahan. And yeah, I think he was the main target, really. And the old adage that it's very important to have a plan, but then all plans go out the window at the first contact with the enemy. So
like
the chaos
Mike
that
Tyson said.
Tyson has said it, and I think some fairly famous generals as well have said it down through the, going back to the 19th century, very important to have plans, but the plans go out the window very quickly, but then you have to have plan B or whatever, you know. You carry, people are very good at plan B with football and all the rest of it, you know. So
we've plan C as well.
Yeah, sure. Look, it was a disaster in one sense because you know the main people were not got, by the Hutch side. So then that led to the organization of the kickback that came back so brutally against them, you know. Yeah, it wasn't a success, but it certainly, and I suppose in terms of organized crime in general, it was probably a disaster because it did, as you said there, I think maybe woke up authorities that, you know, like, I mean, these pictures have been flashed around the world virtually, you know, of guys running around. Just like something you see in Mexico or in wherever, you know. You don't expect to see this in a European capital city, you know. So, or you don't want to see it, but unfortunately, you do see it in other places in Europe as well. But you know, at that stage, I suppose it was a real time to get down to business here with and deal with this, you know.
100%. And before we finish up 2021, you went over to South America as the Garda liaison officer. What was that experience like? You were obviously, I suppose, stepping out of your comfort zone to try something else. Was it something that kind of drove you as a new opportunity?
Yeah, I think that I had seen over the years, and I'd been in numerous countries around Europe on different investigations, and in the US, and as I mentioned, you know, the international aspect of crime investigation always appealed to me, and this was a new opportunity. This was a new position that was being created back in 2020, 21. The Garda liaison network was being expanded and has been expanded outside. We always had people around Europe and that, but now we were heading to North and South America and over towards the Middle East and now the Far East. And so if people, so I saw an opportunity, I had an interest in it. And I applied for the position in Colombia and spent 3 years there from 2021, September 21. Went over there basically to open up the office you become embedded then in the law enforcement communities in Colombia and indeed elsewhere in South America as well, because we have a number of embassies in Mexico, Chile, Colombia, Brazil, Argentina. And, you know, so, you know, it's a hugely fascinating part of the world to work in, and fantastic people over there as well, doing their best. But the challenges and threats, I would say, are on a different level to what we have here. It's it's huge privilege to have been there, and I have a lot of empathy for the people in South America, in Colombia, and I mean the ordinary decent people, the peasant farmers, etc., who basically scrape eke out a living in out in rural areas of Colombia, and in many instances are under the threat from the guerrilla groups, who basically make their money off the cocaine trade and then use that money to purchase weaponry, to take on the state forces, and also to impose their rule basically on those people in those communities. Forced recruitment of children into those gangs and guerrilla groups, the devastation of the rainforests and environmental pollution that they cause, all of that is a huge problem. And it's driven by the nefarious, I suppose we'll call it, cocaine trade, where people in Europe and in the first world, so-called, where people pay money to consume these products and probably don't realize or even think about the damage that they're doing further back up the chain and back all the way to the campesinos in Colombia, the people that are under threat and are forced to eke out a living, growing the coca plant and mixing the coca paste in absolute squalid conditions inside in the jungle, and I getting to see all that firsthand. It's not something that leaves you, because those people I think deserve support, and in fairness to Ireland, within the EU context, we as a nation invest heavily in Colombia, not just in terms of policing or that, but even more importantly in terms of social training, providing monies for schools, and basically a lot of work going on in that area as well through our embassies there. Fantastic work being done, and one of the reasons that I come onto these shows is because I try to highlight, the problems that the likes of the cocaine trade or the illicit trade causes in those parts of the world where the rule of law basically is weak, and people suffer then accordingly because the criminal groupings step into the void, as I said earlier. As John F. Kennedy said, if for evil to triumph, it's only necessary for good people to do nothing, so that is a kind of a message that people need to get,
And what I like as well, Noel, is why you said that it's not to throw somebody off. Colombia is still a great country. I've heard you saying on another interview. And the last one before we finish up very quickly, the latest, the MV Matthews, the seizure. That was obviously a big operation that took. I was reading an article. You said it over a year to put together. That was obviously something that was successful, and but a lot of kind of specialist groups had to come together to work on it.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of of how international cooperation, how law enforcement people across the virtually across the globe, from Latin America to Europe and over to the Middle East, that criminal groups are transnational, transnational by nature and by necessity for them to operate. I mean, you only need to look at the number of nationalities that have been arrested in recent times down in your region, down there in Munster, people from Central Europe, from Iran, various countries, obviously the UK and Irish, obviously. And these are networks of people that have come together to basically import illegal, huge consignments of drugs up from Latin America, up into Europe, probably via West Africa or whatever routes that they devise. So when there is a group like that taken out, it isn't just about the amount of drugs that's taken. More importantly, it's about how their structure has been destroyed, how they and how the, and the quality of people that's been arrested and sent to prison, because it's risk v reward for them as well. So if the risk is greater and they see people going to prison for long stretches, and they're at their financial loss, they've put, as you said, a year's work into putting together the shipment, and then suddenly it's taken out, and seven or eight people are off to prison for 10, 12, 15 years or whatever. both either here or in other parts of the world. Well, then that's in a huge message to other people that might be have a mind to get involved. So that was, yeah, and you've seen other successes in the region as well. So that work is ongoing, and I think it's very, very important work.
Noel, you're a gent. Thanks so much for coming on now and having a chat about your career and everything that you were involved with. I appreciate your time, so thanks a million.
You're welcome. It isn't every day Mayo Man gets to talk to the Kerry community, you know. So yeah, nice to talk to you, Ian, and best of luck.
Now, unfortunately, that's all we've time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I really appreciate you tuning in as always. Stay tuned in here to Radio Kerry because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. I'll be back at the same time next week from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
You're listening to Standout with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.